This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Dan Rafael is here, senior writer, ESPN, ESPN.com, quarantine expert down in Virginia who has been behind closed doors with his family. How many days now in a row is it for you, Dan?
I believe today is day 19.
Ooh, 19 days.
It's not going away anytime soon because the Virginia governor just yesterday said stay in your house till at least June 1st unless it's an emergency or you got to go to the store or whatever. So me and my wife and my son are hunkered down until June 1st.
So what's your secret to quarantine sanity at this point? I can be sane because I live alone and this is just like a regular Tuesday for me. There's no real difference, but you got a family there, man. What's the secret?
It's a little different because one thing though, as far as being home, that's not so much of a different concept than usual for me because when I'm not traveling for fights, I work at home. So I've been sort of keeping to a similar schedule because I still have some things to do and we still have some stories to write. But yes, with my wife at home and my son at home, who's no longer going to first grade, for the rest of the school year, it's been interesting, but you know, you deal with it. I'd rather be with my family than be alone. So, you know, some might have a difference of opinion. You get through it. You make do.
My difference of opinion. I'm just going to be alone for the foreseeable future as far as that goes. Have you found, Dan, like, everybody in boxing is alone too. I talk to a lot of people on a daily basis. I mean, how are the people you talk to in boxing handling all this?
You know, pretty much I think the same way that we all are. You just, you get dealt a hand and you try to make the best of it. I mean, we all know, at least intellectually, there are not going to be any boxing matches, at least in the United States, for a long time. And I know that people are want to stay positive, want to maintain, the right kind of attitude towards what's happening. But I look at this and, you know, I don't think we're seeing any boxing matches of consequence, at least until probably the end of the summer. You know, I think it might extend into the fall. And one of the reasons I say that is because in boxing, even once things, quote unquote, get back to normal and they're allowed to put matches together and hotels open back up and the casinos open back up and you can mount a promotion and people can travel to an event if they want to without fear of contracting the virus, etc. Even when that's all dealt with, it's still going to be, at least in my opinion, at least 4 or 5 weeks till you can actually have an event because, you know, even if boxers are staying in shape by exercising and doing some road work by themselves and that sort of stuff, you know, the fighters still are going to need, at least I would say, even on a scaled back training camp, you still need 4 weeks probably to get ready for a real fight at the minimum. Not to mention that you have to deal with things like, want to promote the event, you want to sell some tickets, you need to deal with your broadcast partners to iron out the TV schedules, you need to, you know, work with a venue to make sure you secure your arena and or your casino. So there's lots of things that go into that whole process. So it's not like, you know, suddenly things are open for business on a Monday and, you know, a week and a half later they can have a fight. It doesn't quite work like that. And it's, you know, it's the same when baseball or basketball or any of these other sports start up, the athletes are going to need some time to prepare, though. There's going to be another abbreviated spring training or, you know, in the NBA, you know, at least a few days or a week to go through some practices and get themselves physically ready to go. So, you know, this is not automatic. And if you're closed down at minimum until June, in my mind, I think it's going to extend much deeper than that.
Yeah. I mean, look, you said a few things there. One thing, I talked to a promoter actually today that told me that one thing that is going to have to change, at least in the early months that boxing comes back, is you're going to have a lot of catch weights. Like, you need sanctioning bodies to relax some of these rules because fighters actually making weight is going to be difficult for them.
I don't know if you can say suddenly there's a whatever. I'll give you one example. Take, for example, there was supposed to be a world title fight at 140 pounds. I don't see a sanctioning body suddenly saying, okay, you know what, we're going to relax it, still for the title, but they can be 143. I mean, there are certain things you can change and relax and manipulate, but you're not going to change the weight of the division that's been the same for 100 years. I mean, that's just not, in my mind, that's not happening. I would think that would be fraudulent, frankly. I mean, it's not to say they still couldn't have a boxing match. I mean, I'll give you an example. Maurice Hooker and Regis Prograis are supposed to have a fight on April 17th. Obviously, that was postponed. that they are two former junior welterweight champions who are going to fight at 143 pounds. Certainly, there's no reason that fight couldn't still happen, you know, at whatever weight they decide, because it's not for a title. But if Jose Ramirez and Victor Postol are in the same weight class, or Josh Taylor and his mandatory from Thailand are going to still do their fights when they're rescheduled, there's 140-pound fights. So, you know, make the weight or don't fight until you can make the weight. So I don't see the organizations changing that element of the sport. Maybe some other things that they can deal with, but the weight is the weight if you're fighting in a world title fight, in my mind.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I do think that some of those non-title fights, you'll see the weight fluctuate. Like an example would be probably, you know, Kovalev versus Sullivan Barrera, if that winds up being made early on. That's a catchweight anyway.
Right, that was already supposed to be like, I think 180 or something like that was the weight. So that was already going to be over the weight, and that was fine, I think, with both fighters. You know, but those are all things that people are going to have to take into account. But if you've signed to fight a welterweight title fight or a cruiserweight title fight or whatever, you know, that there's weight limits ascribed to those divisions, you know, so unless it's a heavyweight fight or a non-title fight, you know, I think that the fighters are stuck with those weights, period.
What do you think? I mean, the other thing you said there was that the end of the summer, and look, I've heard people say the same thing about the end of the summer as when boxing comes back. What about the idea of fighting behind closed doors? What have you been hearing about, you know, plans that could be in place for that to happen sooner?
I have talked to the people that are involved with commissions and that sort of thing about that possibility. And on the surface, it sounds like a good idea. Obviously, you know, you obviously no spectators are going to be in harm's way if you do it behind closed doors. But I talked to one regulator and we had this conversation, and it was very simple. That even if you keep spectators away, you still have all the people that are involved with the commission. You still have the boxers and their teams. You still have the promotional people. You still have, you know, even if you do a stripped down version of a production, you still have dozens of people that are involved in the production of the event for television. There's no reason to do an event behind closed doors if you can't broadcast it, because what's the purpose of that? So let's say it's a top ranked ESPN event. You need at least, even if you cut it back dramatically, you're probably talking about at least 30 to 40 people on the production team, you know, and broadcasters as well. I mean, you know, when you do a fight on DAZN, you know how many people are there in the trucks and production assistants and floor managers and, you know, and all the different people that are involved in making that happen. You also have, in a closed event, you're still going to have some security people, you know, people that are logistical for the whatever venue you put the event in. You're still talking probably about, even if you cut it down as much as possible, at least 100 plus people, maybe 200 people. So the point is, those people still have to make sure that they are not infected with the virus. They have to go through all that business to make sure that they're safe. Now, how do you do that? You have a weigh-in, for example. Let's say the fight's on a Saturday. You do the weigh-in on a Friday afternoon. Everybody makes weight, and everybody's tested who's involved in the event, and they're all free and clear of the virus. So now what? What happens between the time of the weigh-in and the time of the event? You're going to quarantine people, and, you know, even like the security guard or the janitor or the person that does the catering, you're gonna have them stay over. It doesn't seem feasible to me to do that. Not to mention the fact that take the Nevada commission, for example. Nevada, their governor has said, like many states around the country, that you are not to report to work if you're not essential. I don't think anybody is going to say that the Nevada State Athletic Commission is essential and that they should work at home. So Bob Bennett, who I've talked to a few times during all this, he's been doing work as best as he can, but he's been doing it from home. He's not going into the office. They'll have a commission meeting, for example, but it won't be in person in the office building. They have it in the Sawyer building in Vegas. They'll do it over the telephone. The point is, even if everything could be worked out, if Nevada says no non-essential personnel are going to go to an event, you can't have your judges and your inspectors and your commissioners and your executive director and all those people, the referees, the judges, show up at an event behind closed doors. So yes, it's a great idea in theory. I find it extremely difficult to see how it can be done just on a sheer logistical standpoint.
Yeah, look, I think you're right, because for all the reasons you articulated there, and the only way that it becomes feasible is if the testing changes in such a dramatic way that you can have those drive-up 15-minute tests available like they're thermometers. Like, you can just walk into a CVS and grab one and do it.
Maybe that can happen over the next few months. But as it stands now, even people who really need a test can't get the test in many places around this country. So, you know, I think a boxer, you know, wanting to do an event behind closed doors is not necessarily on the top of the priority list in terms of people that need to have testing.
No, I agree. It would have to, you'd have to see a dramatic shift in the next couple of months. I do wonder though, Dan, like you mentioned the commissions and absolutely the biggest commissions are important, but you can go to like casino, like Mohegan Sun, for an example. You can go to these Indian reservation casinos and their rules are a little bit different. Generally speaking, they abide by the state rules, but they don't have to. Like they can do whatever they want. So I'm curious if we see promoters try to go that route, you know, if they feel they can do things, if they feel they can do things safely, but maybe commissions aren't quite ready to go there yet.
I mean, that is possible. I mean, there are a number of Indian reservations around the country that have casinos that have hosted boxing events. You know, the last fight that we saw, at least in this country of any consequence, at least in terms of television, was the Showbox fight. That was, I don't know, I guess, at this point, I guess, what, like 2 weeks ago? They did it in a...
Time has no meaning anymore. Time has no meaning anymore.
Anyway, but that fight was in Hinckley, Minnesota, and it was regulated not by the Minnesota Athletic Commission folks. It was regulated by the local tribal commission that was involved with that casino. And they did that event with no spectators. So it was just the Showtime crew and the boxers on the card and, again, the people I mentioned that needed to be there. So it was very limited in terms of the folks that were there. I don't know the exact number, but I had by looking on the TV and seeing people, there were some people sitting in the seats. There were fighters that were on the card, maybe their girlfriend or their mom and dad or whatever. There still had to be at least 100 people there. They went through with it, but again, that was a couple of weeks ago when the severity of what's been going on, I don't think, was known just quite yet. I'm not sure if those people in that tribal commission would do the same event today that they were willing to do just a few weeks ago. So. You know, your point is well taken. It's possible, but you know, I don't know if Indian reservation is going to want to take that gamble either. I mean, they still have employees and families and people that are going to be there. That I don't think anybody wants to put people unnecessarily in harm's way.
And no, I agree with that.
Keep in mind, though, wherever those Indian reservations are, they may have their own commissions, but they're still under the auspices of their state government. So, you know, if there was a casino down the street from my house in Virginia. And they want to do an event, if the governor of the state says no essential travel, everybody stay home, you know, they could still face, you know, punishment or fines or whatever for breaking that. So it's complicated, but, you know, I think everybody's going to have to take a deep breath and realize that there's not going to be any boxing of any magnitude, in my opinion, at least in this country for the first half of the year, except for what we've already seen.
Yeah, and use the phrase of any magnitude, and that's what interests me too. Like, I think when boxing comes back, I'm still not convinced it comes back in front of 18 to 20,000 people in Las Vegas or 80,000 people in Wembley Stadium in the UK. I'm wondering, you know, just what decisions the Canelo Alvarez's of the world, the Anthony Joshua's of the world, what decisions do they make? Do they elect to fight, you know, in August, September, whenever it may be, in front of smaller crowds and less gate revenue? Or do they hold out and say, all right, well, maybe we'll wait till December and hope that I can get the revenue that comes with it?
You know, that's a good question, because you're talking about a Canelo Alvarez fight. It's one thing if you were to roll out a handful of fights in front of small crowds. For example, before things were canceled, you know, I had talked to Bob Arum from Top Rank. They were willing to do the Shakur Stevenson event that was supposed to be in mid-March and the Michael Conlon fight that was a couple of days later at the Madison Square Garden Theater in New York City. They were willing to do those fights with no crowd and give up their gate revenue. I said to Bob, I said, well, you know, how much money were you talking about? Because obviously they're still going to get a license fee from ESPN. In terms of the gate revenue, Bob estimated that between the two shows that the Shakur show was on track to generate a gate probably north of $250,000, probably closer to $300,000, and that the Michael Conlon fight, you know, not being a world title fight, being on a weeknight on a Tuesday, would have drawn a little bit less in terms of the money, even though he's a popular fighter. So, you know, Top Rank probably lost out in terms of gate revenue. They were willing to give up probably about $500,000-ish in the gate. So that's still a hit for any company. When you're talking about a Canelo Alvarez fight, where the gate generates literally on the worst night of a Canelo big fight, you're talking about a gate probably in the $8 to $9 million neighborhood. And for a bigger fight, you know, you're talking about, I mean, the Triple G fights were well in excess of $20 million. So, you know, that's a huge part of the overall revenue for an event. You cannot put that fight on and give that up under the same financial model that currently exists. Now, if Canelo wants to alter his, you know, what he requires or the companies or whatever, you know, that's one thing. But under the terms of what they usually do, nobody's giving up that kind of money. An Anthony Joshua fight with 70,000 people on June 20th at that new stadium in London, probably would generate a gate, you know, because the ticket prices are cheaper. That's probably, you're looking at a gate of like around $10 million. That's not insignificant. You know, that's basically what pays for the opponent and lots of other things as part of the event. So that is a massive part of their revenue. I don't think that happens. Now, on a smaller card, possibly. A promoter might be willing to give that up. But on a bigger show, I just don't see it.
All right, Dan, let's talk a little bit about some things involving actual boxing right now. If things had not gone the way they've gone, Billy Joe Saunders would have been in line to face Canelo Alvarez in May. Decent fight. Saunders, a real title holder, undefeated. Talks a big game. So that was the plan anyway, but everything's now in flux with everything that's gone on right now. And Billy Joe Saunders may be talking his way out of the fight entirely. Saunders, who continues to put his foot in his mouth, he very recently found himself in hot water again. A video posted on social media where he's hitting a punching bag and describing it as what a man would do when his wife or girlfriend nags him too much during all this quarantine. It's basically paraphrasing what he said. Not the first time Saunders has been in trouble for stuff like this. What do you make of all this, Dan? Why is Billy Joe Saunders so self-destructive? And what impact does his comments and the British Boxing's decision, Board of Control's decision to suspend him, what impact does that have on his future?
Well, he's just a dope, number one. Number two, I'm going to take exception with two things you said. He said he keeps putting his foot in his mouth. I hope that somebody put their fist in his mouth, number two. And also, you called him a real title holder. I don't think he's a real title holder at all. The guy won a vacant title against a complete nobody and then made a defense in which he looked absolutely horrendous and barely won. You know, he got the stoppage, but it was an abysmal performance. So, again, against a complete nobody opponent as well. So, you know, yes, he has a belt and he has a nice record and he talks a lot. So, therefore, Canelo, after much discussion about him or Callum Smith, rather, opted to fight Billy Joe Saunders. But honestly, that fight does not do a lot for me. I don't think it does a lot for any boxing fan. As far as how the suspension that he was given by the British Boxing Board, you know, he is suspended, but they have to have a meeting to determine the length of that suspension. So that is completely unknown at this moment, how they're going to do that, when they're going to do that, how they're going to meet. You know, that's completely up in the air. And because it's under the UK system, it's not a guarantee that license would be withheld in the United States. Now, Nevada, where the fight is supposed to take place, they may look at that. They may ask some questions, but, you know, in the end, they would certainly be within their authority to give him a license in Nevada. So, you know, he could be in some trouble in terms of that fight. I think more so than whatever suspension he may take is because the fight is going to be backed up so much that it may end up going away just based on the length of time it may take to get it in the ring. And when you talk to the fighters and their teams, and certainly the people at DAZN who are supposed to pay a lot of money for these fights that involve fighters like Canelo and Triple G, they may get their way and say, look, let's just scrap this Saunders fight. That's not, again, not a terrible fight, but it by no means is it a huge event for the whole public. Same goes with Triple G's fight that he's supposed to have against the mandatory challenger, Zermeta. That was supposed to be in early June, which probably won't happen either, and say, look, guys, let's just do this one. And it would give DAZN the opportunity in a moment in time where they're struggling big time because they have no other programming, right? They have nothing at the moment because there's no live sports, particularly boxing, which is what they've hitched their wagon to at this moment when they don't have rights to big leagues. Basically use a Triple G Canelo third fight to sort of, you know, we're back, relaunch things with arguably one of the biggest fights in the entire sport. I think that could happen, but again, I don't have inside knowledge of that. But I think that Billy Joe's trek towards this fight may be more knocked off track because of what I just mentioned, as opposed to whatever suspension he may take from the British regulators.
First, there is tremendous quality programming on DAZN right now, including Jabs with Mannix and Mora, and this podcast that you're on right now, Raphael, the video version of this podcast.
I only meant in terms of the live fights. Listen, if you're a subscriber to DAZN or ESPN Plus or these other services, you know, there's plenty of material to watch in the libraries to get you through the day if you're bored because of the fact that most people are staying in. But at the end, you know, the business is still modeled on live events. All that other stuff is great, but it's kind of like gravy. You know, the steak is the big fight, is the big event. And, you know, there's no doubt that those companies are going to struggle until they can produce some of that live programming. But yes, I don't miss the Mannix podcast or the Jabs. I could live without Sergio Mora a little bit, right?
I could live with a little less Sergio Mora as well. I do like they're doing something now with Oscar De La Hoya watching back his old fights, which is actually kind of cool to like hear Oscar, you know, think about what he was thinking against Gotti and some of these other fights. I think that's so. But I'm with you. You have to have live events to thrive in this business. I think any way Canelo should just move past Saunders. Don't try to rush back for a Saunders fight where he could easily take you the distance and, you know, put in jeopardy a potential fight in September against Golovkin. That's where all the money is. You can fight Golovkin in September, and you can come back in December if you want and take a big fight against a Saunders if you want to do it in the UK, a Murata if you want to do it in Japan. There's still opportunity here, Dan, for Canelo to fight twice this year.
Yeah, you just do it in the other order. You know, if the idea was to fight, you know, the Saunders level fight, and they had been discussing with Murata before Saunders, there was this discussion of Callum Smith. You know, you can certainly, if things are back up and running, you could do it in the other order. He is supposed to fight twice a year. You know, when he first joined the zone, he fought the first fight in December, which was not that long after his second fight with Triple G. So yes, it is certainly possible that under that scenario, he could do that. He went from Triple G to the Rocky Fielding fight and then came back in May and did the fight with Daniel Jacobs. So yeah, no, that is certainly possible. I know they like to keep that September date because that's still a big deal for Canelo, given that it's the weekend of the Mexican Independence Day. Yeah, but I think, look, the biggest thing that's going to be going on in boxing when things do get ramped up is how the promotional companies get their guys back in, not that they get them back in the ring, but in what order do they get them? You'd like to think that the guys who had fights canceled out or postponed, they're first back in. But that's then going to knock everybody else off schedule also. I think what we're looking at, and I don't know, you know, this is going to, a lot of it's going to be up to the broadcast outlets, whether it's ESPN or DAZN or how Fox and Showtime handle their PBC arrangements. I mean, you could, you know, jam basically 9 months of fights into like, you know, 4 or 5 months and basically have something significant every single week, not every other week. Unfortunately, it's going to also be probably even more of a case where you have, you know, good shows on top of each other on the same day, which, you know, nobody likes to see the clash of two events on the same night. It happens a lot these days, but it may be even more once things get ramped up. I mean, there's going to be a lot of things for people to figure out. I was thinking about and using with one of the people in the business about, you know, let's say Top Rank they've had to cancel like, I think, 6 or 7 shows so far. You know, if it's conceivable that you find a location that's into it, let's say, you know, you go to like an MGM or wherever, or, you know, a Hulu theater, wherever you may do your event, and literally do like, you know, 4 or 5 shows over the span of like 2 weeks in the same location, just bang them out one after another. It would give the broadcaster plenty of inventory. You know, it would certainly create a lot of interest from the fans if you were getting, you know, quality events one after another after another. I mean, it's not a perfect scenario. You usually like to let events, you know, breathe a little bit, build up a little bit, get some attention, some media. But that could be one way where they could try to get their fighters and their business back on track by pumping out, you know, a whole series of quality events in a more compressed time frame.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If sports comes roaring back, you're going to have not just fights on top of fights, but, you know, fights on top of golf tournaments, fights on top of tennis tournaments, NFL, college football. I mean, it's going to come back in a big time wave. Let me ask you though, the idea that Canelo doesn't need the Saunders fight, I buy, because Canelo's coming off a Fighter of the Year campaign, was brilliant in 2019. Golovkin, not so much. I mean, Golovkin, not a perfect performance against Steve Rolls, a guy he should have just completely blown up, most likely had a tough second round there. The fight with Derevyanchenko was nip and tuck right away, all the way to the very end. Does Golovkin need a fight in between? Should he be more interested in trying to take on a Zeremeta to get himself in the kind of condition and shape he needs to be in to fight Canelo?
I guess in a perfect world, probably. But he's the one that's been the most desperate, the most begging of the Canelo fight. It's been Canelo that's sort of like kind of, you know, doesn't really care one way or the other, apparently, if he has the fight. I mean, when he agreed that he would fight him a third time in the fall, you know, he was there to extract more money out of the deal to make it worth his while to go for a fight that he feels like he doesn't need, because, you know, again, this is not my opinion. Canelo will tell you he feels like he beat him twice, you know, at the very least in the rematch, and doesn't really see a need for that fight. So Golovkin's the one that's really wanted it. But, you know, at his age and with the layoff, you know, a fight against Zermenta might not be the worst thing, but he's not in a position to demand that or command that at all. You know, we'll see what happens. I'm sure that if the opportunity to skip that fight is available to him and he can go right into a Canelo fight in the fall, you know, that's probably what he would do. It's sort of like what you were mentioning earlier, Chris, about, you know, dealing with fighters with the weight situation. You know, there's going to be a lot of things that aren't perfect when they come back. But that said, I would say every fighter out there, there will be boxing again. So they should all, if you're going to think you're going to fight sometime in the fall, you know, I'm not saying you're going to make your weight tomorrow, but you should be, you know, in the vicinity knowing that you may only have 4 weeks to get to the weight. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to get as ready as you can. And if they can't, it's going to be on them, not on anybody else.
How significant an underdog do you make Golovkin in that third fight? I mean, given what we know about Canelo and where he is in his career, still just 29 years old, and Golovkin approaching 37 years old. I mean, how big an underdog is he?
He's an underdog, no doubt about it. You know, he, like you mentioned, he won against Rolls. He knocked him out, but he did not look that good. He got touched up a little bit more than you would have thought. There are many people that felt like he lost to Devonchenko, period. Even if you felt he won the fight, it was an extremely physical, grinding, grueling, difficult, hard. You know, it's probably the worst physical abuse that Triple G has ever taken in any fight in his entire career. And that includes both fights against Canelo Alvarez. So, you know, while Golovkin is still a fantastic fighter, he's still pound for pound quality, he's still, you know, near the top of the sport, still one of the best middleweights in the world. It's very obvious, and this is not in any way an anti-Triple G. I've been one of the biggest Triple G guys out there, supporters for his entire campaign since he's first come on the scene in America. I was following him even back when he was still in Germany. So the point I'm making, though, is he's over the other side of the mountain. He's still high near the top, but it's, you know, he's on the decline. That's all there is to it. It may not be, you know, a massive decline, but clearly he has lost a little bit at least, even if you want to be charitable. Whereas Canelo still looks fantastic. He's still, in my mind, still adding to his arsenal. He's not taking huge punishment in his fights. He trains his rear end off. He's got a good team around him. And, you know, he's still, in my mind, still in his prime at age 29. So, you know, I think by the time they meet a third time, you know, we may get, you know, a more definitive of outcome in terms of Canelo winning the fight. I think Triple G, you know, I've thought about this, you know, his best thing may just be to just let it all hang out and just, you know, run right to him and make it a Hagler-Hearns kind of fight and just see if he can blast him. Because one thing Triple G does have that has not gone away with the age is he still can, you know, crack. He's still got great punching power. Why not see if you can land one of those big shots and then just go for it?
Yeah, I think that might be his only chance to win. I don't think he'd outbox Canelo in a third fight, but maybe you can clip him and knock him out. On Golovkin, you know, he made the trainer change over a year ago. He's had a couple of fights with Jonathan Banks. How would you evaluate that? I mean, we just talked about how he didn't look great last year. How much of that do you put on Banks and things he's done, and how much of it is on Golovkin and where he is in his career?
You know, it's kind of like which came first, the chicken or the egg. It's sort of like you really never know. Obviously, when he fought Steve Rolls, that was the first fight that he had with John. They had a very short period of time together. I remember going to the news conference in Vegas when they announced that Jonathan would become Gennady's new trainer. You know, and Jonathan's a good guy, and he's a very knowledgeable boxing person. He learned from Manuel Stewart the best. He had a good professional career himself as a heavyweight. He was under no false illusions that suddenly in a handful of weeks that he's suddenly going to make some dramatic change to Triple G. And Triple G didn't need any kind of dramatic change. You need somebody there to make sure you're in shape and you run through the things the proper way. So whatever went down in the Steve Rolls fight, you know, one way or the other, I don't think that's on Banks at all. You know, in the Devonchenko fight, again, I don't know if I don't think they had the wrong plan in that fight. I think that Jonathan Banks can't make Golovkin not show his age. So, you know, I don't know if I put much on the trainer in the Triple G situation. Part of it is the way that he fights and the wear and tear that he's taken and the age. I mean, you know, there are no miracle workers when you reach a certain age in this sport. I mean, you know, you could take an old, you know, when Muhammad Ali was at the end, you know, could have still given him, you know, all the greatest trainers in the world. It wasn't going to turn back the clock against Larry Holmes or against Trevor Burton. You could have given him Angelo, Dundee, Emmanuel Stewart, Teddy Atlas, Freddie Roach, you know, pick all the great trainers in the history of the sport. wasn't going to help him. He can throw Eddie Futch in there also. You know, at that age, he was done. The trainer can come up with a great game plan and make sure the guy's in shape and in condition, but they can't fight for him.
Yeah, and look, I think if you want to look at the history of Golovkin's trainers, I mean, I don't know that Abel Sanchez distinguished himself in that second Canelo fight. I mean, he didn't really have a great game plan to counteract Canelo coming straight at Golovkin. I mean, they begged Canelo to come straight at him, and he did, and he came right at him.
And the one thing that was said in the lead up to that fight is, where are the body punches? Which is something that Triple G, you know, is extremely adept at doing, and he's very good at it. We've seen him score knockouts with body punches, and it just disappeared. And, you know, you can yell in the corner or yell in training camp all you want about what you should use, a certain weapon you should employ, but if the fighter, you know, either can't or won't, what are you supposed to do? So I've always been kind of torn about this, but I believe this very strongly. I think that the trainer in boxing is very overrated in many ways. Not that they don't provide and do a big service. Sometimes they can make a huge difference, a massive difference. I mean, look at what Freddie Roach did with Miguel Cotto when he got him late in his career. Look what Emmanuel Stewart did when he took on Vladimir Klitschko. So there are some that you can pick out that make a dramatic difference. But just fight to fight to fight to fight, you know, it doesn't necessarily make that big of a difference. And I've always believed that the trainer – you know, who the fighter picks has to be the guy that they're comfortable with. So there was a lot of discussion, for example, going into the rematch between Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury, which seems now about a million years ago, even though it was only like a month and a half ago, last big fight that we may be seeing for a long time. But the point is that when Tyson Fury went into that fight, a lot of people questioned, why would you switch trainers from Ben Davison to go to Sugar Hill when you had done very well with Ben as your trainer? You had drawn with Wilder in the first fight, even though many people had thought that he deserved the win. And Fury made a good point. He says, look, a draw is not a win. So I had to change something. And he switched trainers, and he came out and he said all the things he was going to do. He actually did them. And so in that particular instance, even though maybe the trainer wouldn't have made that much of a difference in most people's minds, it doesn't matter what I think, what you think, what fans think, what his promoter thinks. If the fighter thinks it makes a difference, then they have to do what they have to do. Because the only person that the trainer has to answer to is the boxer. The boxer has to feel comfortable with the guy in the corner. I mean, they can put a potted plant in the corner with a guy. If that fighter feels comfortable with the potted plant, then so be it. That's the way I look at it. So if back to what we're talking about with Triple G and Canelo, if Triple G is comfortable with Jonathan Banks as his trainer, whatever lessons he's teaching in the gym or whatever he's preaching or showing him, makes no difference. As long as Golovkin thinks it's the right thing and he's comfortable with it, that's all that matters.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a great point about trainers. I'm just curious how that all plays out with Canelo. If Jonathan Banks comes up with a game plan that's more interesting, I guess, than what he had in the last fight. Dan, always appreciate it. And by the way, I read one of your recent columns on ESPN.com. Welcome to Team Charlo Andrade. I would like to welcome you to the family.
We got to get into that a little bit.
I'll talk about this till the end of days. Like, this is the best fight to be made in boxing, period. You can take all your other fights. I want Andrade versus Charlo.
I wrote that in that piece because people who are not familiar, I've been doing these resets of the divisions since there's not a lot of fights going on or no fights going on. We were like, okay, let's take two divisions. We'll not, you know, at the very bottom of the weight scale, we'll do three, but we'll come up with a series of questions and we'll sort of reset the division. So it was sort of like, you know, what's the biggest question I have about the division? Who's the biggest star in the division? What's the fight you want to see the most? Who's the dark horse in the division? So I've been going through systematically, division by division, and writing those stories. And when I got to the middleweight division, and it was the question posed was, what's the fight you want to see? I thought to myself, we all know that Triple G and Canelo is the big fight, but we've already seen that twice. And while I'm not opposed to a third fight, I was trying to think, what's another good fight? So I thought to myself, my good friend Chris Mannix has been driving me and everybody else in this sport nuts for months about his love and desire for Charlo Andrade. And I was like, you know what? I don't agree with Chris about everything, but you know what? I'm gonna give the man props on this one. So I picked that one. Your name does not appear in the column, but that was for you, my friend. And but in all seriousness, I agree. We know we've seen Canelo and Triple G fight twice before. You know, I think a lot of people kind of think they know what's going to happen in the third fight. Charlo and Andrade are both guys who are excellent fighters. They've both been junior middleweight champions. They're both now with titles at middleweight. Neither of them have had a defining fight yet in their career. They need a big name. They need something that's going to get the fans excited. They need competition. And the winner of that fight, and by the way, those guys are the two guys that probably most people would place right behind Golovkin and Canelo in the middleweight division, perhaps Derevchenko, whatever. But they're clearly among those elite fighters in that 160-pound weight class. And if you really want to get a shot at the winner of Canelo versus Triple G3, you know, earn it. The guy that would have win a fight between Charlo and Andre, which I happen to think would be a good fight because they've been talking a little smack with each other. Andre is a master boxer. Charlo can box too, but likes to come forward and make him and mix it up a little bit. I think it's a good style fight. The guy that wins that fight, by acclamation, will have the public saying, you know what, that guy deserves to get a fight with a Canelo caliber opponent or a Triple G. And, you know, they don't have to go out there beg for a big fight. They'll have earned that position. And on top of that, very makeable, at least in terms of Canelo, Triple G, and Andre all being with DAZN. Charlo, while he's with PBC, he's not bound to any network. Eddie Hearn has been out there offering him sick amounts of money in recent times. Do the fight. Take the money. If you win, you can go back to your PBC home and fight on Showtime or Fox. If you lose, you know, your career's not over. You know, to me, it makes all the sense in the world. So I'm on Team Mannix. I love that fight.
Welcome to Charlo, the Charlo Andrade family. And look, I you know, people know, listening to this podcast, I work for DAZN. I'm part of the broadcast team there. But, like, I wouldn't care if that fight wound up on Showtime or Fox. It doesn't matter to me. I'd be there ringside.
I know you well enough. I know you well enough over these years to know that, yes, you know, you do work for them. Same way I work for ESPN. But I have often advocated for fights that could be on other networks, the same way you have, because we take our checks from one place, but we want to see the best fights, and that is one of the best fights.
And let me say this, like, and as I say that, you know, if you're Charlo, like, you obviously are loyal to Al Haymon, I get that. A lot of fighters are, deservedly so. But, like, the Eddie Hearn side of the street represents so much money. Like, even if you win the fight against Andrade, you get probably get a shot at Canelo at some point in the very near future. You would, like you said, you become by acclamation the next man up. If you lose, you've talked about moving to 168 anyway. You got Danny Jacobs up there. Jacobs, who you've been back and forth with for years about fighting. Jacobs wants to fight you.
You've also made like $7 million.
Those two fights, you're over 10.
I'll quote the great philosopher Floyd Mayweather one time talking about some humongous fight that he was involved with where everybody was making, this is before he was making, you know, $100 million plus a fight. Maybe he was making, you know, $20 million for the fight. When you're making that kind of money, there are no losers.
Yeah. Well, Dan, just for that, I'm sending you and your son Charlo Andrade t-shirts. So look for them in the Virginia mail at some point in the immediate future. Dan, always appreciate it, man. Great stuff. Keep up the good work. And thanks for joining me here.
You bet. Let's all get through the pandemic together.